endocrine surgeon in San Francisco found that he could do most of his surgical follow-up appointments by video, though he still insisted on meeting patients in person before surgery. Psychotherapists moved online with varying results. Internists handled many problems by taking a history from a patient via online video conference and then providing advice or calling in a prescription. Many of the specialty referrals that primary care doctors handled could also be managed remotely. One of my colleagues at Yale, physician Patrick O'Connor, told me that, with respect to telemedicine, more was accomplished in 2 weeks than in 5 years. The pointlessness of much in-person medical practice was driven home by another physician colleague, Michael Barnett, who noted that a major reason that patients came in to see their doctors had nothing to do with good medical care or their clinical needs. Many of these appointments were to satisfy insurance regulations that mandated visits for routine matters, like getting a prescription refill, that could easily be handled remotely. In fact, much of the work of primary care internists could be done without tethering them to the exam room, and the switch to telemedicine revived one of the hallmarks of good medical care, taking a careful medical history. Many physicians were happy to see this confirmed. The outpatient medical clinic at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston shifted to mostly online care in the spring of 2020 and found that only 5% of patients needed in-person visits. In May 2020, after the peak of the first wave of the pandemic had passed, Yale New Haven Hospital announced that it planned to take advantage of a strategic opportunity to expand in this area, and it set the target that by July 2020, at least one-third of ambulatory visits would be converted to telehealth. The pandemic highlighted how much of medical care could be provided at home, especially when paired with devices such as home blood pressure cuffs, glucose monitors, and oximeters to gather basic information. The changes introduced to make this sort of care permissible during the peak of the crisis are unlikely to be abandoned as the pandemic wanes. The venues and the types of providers who offer various services will likely change over time, and certain medications, such as birth control pills and travel vaccines, may eventually be available without a doctor visit, in the same way that pharmacies now provide routine flu shots. Policy experts, such as physician and ethicist Zeke Emanuel, have pointed out that a number of policy interventions could capitalize on these insights and improve the American healthcare system. For example, an online visit with a doctor should be reimbursed at the exact same rate as an office visit for the same problem. Otherwise, the pricing structure will perversely incentivize doctors to have patients come to the office. Incredibly, many hospitals actually lost money or faced bankruptcy during the pandemic, despite being packed with patients and despite providing a critical life-saving service to our nation, because reimbursement for caring for seriously ill people with infection is less than reimbursement for elective procedures for trivial problems. This made no sense before the pandemic and no sense afterward. Reimbursement policies are sure to change as the pandemic ebbs. The pandemic also highlighted the long-standing issues of iatrogenic, doctor-caused illnesses or injuries arising in the course of medical care. By some metrics, this problem is a leading killer in our society, resulting in as many as 50,000 to 100,000 deaths every year in and out of hospitals. Medical errors run the gamut, from surgical mistakes, leaving a sponge in somebody's abdomen, to medication mistakes, prescribing Lasix instead of Losec, for instance. One is a diuretic and the other reduces stomach acid. People associate medical error with a surgeon accidentally removing the wrong kidney, but hospital-acquired, also known as nosocomial, infections happen vastly more often. Things like urinary tract infections, surgical site infections, lung infections, bloodstream infections. The ugly truth is that most of these stem from preventable breakdowns in sterile procedures, that is, poor hygiene. Overall, possibly as many as 1% of patients admitted to American hospitals die from a medical mistake. Doctors know this. When I was doing my medical internship at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center in Philadelphia in 1989, a senior doctor advised the new interns to think carefully before admitting patients. Hospital admission is not a benign procedure, he cautioned. Americans often equate more with better when it comes to medicine, but much data suggests otherwise. One way to assess the potentially deadly impact of healthcare is to look at what happens when doctors go on strike. This is a rare event, but an analysis of 5 strikes by physicians around the world, occurring between 1976 and 2003 and lasting between 9 days and 17 weeks, showed that, overall, mortality either stayed the same or declined during the strike. Possible explanations for a decrease in mortality include a delay in elective surgeries, with their attendant risks, and a decline in medical errors and injuries. What about other times when doctors are relatively unavailable? One study examined mortality among elderly Americans who had heart attacks or heart failure and were hospitalized during the 2 annual national cardiology conferences when fewer cardiologists were available to treat them over the course of 10 years. The study found that of the tens of thousands of patients with heart failure who were admitted during meeting days when they were cared for by doctors who were not cardiologists, 17.5% died, and of the tens of thousands of heart failure patients who were admitted during non-meeting days when they were cared for by cardiologists, 24.8% died. Yes, cardiac patients died less when cardiologists did not get their hands on them. Cardiac mortality was not affected by patients being hospitalized during oncology, gastroenterology, or orthopedics conferences, when other specialists were away but cardiologists were present. Finally, the authors cleverly looked at gastrointestinal hemorrhage and hip fracture mortality and found those conditions were unaffected by hospitalization during the cardiology meetings. It really did seem that the cardiologists and their interventions were causing some cardiac patients to die at a higher rate. As a doctor, I find this extraordinarily demoralizing. During the spring of 2020, hospitals deferred elective procedures and non-emergency visits for all conditions, both to protect patients from infection exposure and to preserve surge capacity for COVID-19 patients. And patients themselves chose to stay away for minor or even serious conditions. As a result, it's likely the deaths from medical mistakes or overtreatment declined. A colleague of mine, physician H. Gilbert Welch, argued that we were probably previously treating too many minor issues, everything from mammographic irregularities, which might disappear on their own, to mild heart attacks, which often have better outcomes without medical care than with it, since patients are often subjected to risky procedures driven more by the financial exigencies of the hospitals and specialists than by the patient's needs. The pandemic forced hospitals to increase the threshold for admitting sick patients so as to keep beds available for COVID-19 patients. Similarly, doctors order billions of dollars of unnecessary tests and procedures every year, but the coronavirus pandemic provided a lesson in their lack of utility. So, just like the pandemic gave us a glimpse of a world with less traffic, it also gave us a glimpse of a world with less medical injury. It's a lesson the medical system is likely to internalize, because healthcare workers certainly do not want to harm people. Once detailed studies of the vast natural experiment provided by COVID-19 are analyzed in the post-pandemic period, thresholds for the treatment of a host of conditions are likely to be reconsidered. Though iatrogenesis is real, I do not mean to impugn medical professionals whose hard work and dedication are profound and whose efforts saved the lives of countless patients during the pandemic. Medicine is a profession, not merely an occupation. But as we saw before with the cases of staff being muzzled for revealing PPE shortages, healthcare providers are increasingly seen as cogs in a vast bureaucratic machine. Yet fundamentally, physicians and nurses are supposed to put the needs of their patients above their own. If your shift ends and the patient is sick and needs you, you do not just go home. You stay at the bedside. And indeed, physicians and nurses are supposed to take risks in times of infectious disease, as we have seen. Therefore, a final way in which the pandemic will change medicine is that the generation of doctors in training during the crisis are likely to have to confront their fears and think about their duty in a different way. I think training during a pandemic will heighten their sense of calling. For some trainees, no doubt, it will also affect the specialty they pick, with some of them finding infectious disease or public health more appealing. Contact with mortality has a way of driving a search for meaning among doctors, just as it does for anyone else. Perhaps most important, I think training during a large-scale deadly infectious outbreak will affect the maturation of a whole cohort of trainees, enhancing their sense of purpose and responsibility. Some medical schools and nursing schools accelerated their graduations in the spring of 2020 so they could place more staff into the field immediately. When I was a new intern in 1989 and struggling to find my identity as a physician, my father-in-law, James E. Zuckerman, an obstetrician-gynecologist trained in the previous generation, told me a story about his own internship in 1961 that has stuck with me. On his very first evening on call, he was taken aside by the senior neurosurgery resident who was supervising him and oriented to the heavy demands he would face that night at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, a famously extreme environment, perhaps the largest hospital in the world at the time, so huge that it had its own police precinct. In the event that the intern should face challenges during the night that he thought he could not handle, the senior resident advised, "Jimmy, tonight, you can call a doctor or you can be a doctor." The pandemic also reshaped our economy in numerous ways over the immediate and intermediate terms, causing one of the largest global recessions in history. On March 27, 2020, Congress passed the CARES, Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, an almost inconceivably large trillion-dollar rescue package. We could establish a colony on Mars for less money. By the second quarter report on the American economy, released by the Commerce Department on July 30, 2020, the devastation was apparent. The American GDP fell by 9.5% and had an annualized decline of 32.9%, a drop so rapid and deep that it was unprecedented in our history. At this time as well, 30 million Americans were still receiving unemployment benefits after 19 straight weeks of new unemployment claims exceeding 1 million. These losses would have been worse without the CARES Act and other measures. Nearly 5 years of growth in the American economy had been wiped away by the virus in just a few months. Many fear that if high numbers of deaths resumed in the winter of 2020, and if people had to continue the non-pharmaceutical interventions, the overall economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic could even surpass that of the Great Depression. As long as the virus poses a material threat to life, many people will not be willing to completely resume normal activities, such as eating out, or engage in many pre-pandemic purchasing behaviors. This reduced demand will unavoidably keep the United States in recession into the intermediate pandemic period. Though the economy as a whole slowed down, some industries were forced into overdrive by the virus. We have seen how hospitals and healthcare facilities had to rise to the occasion. But morgues, funeral homes, crematories, and cemeteries also had to cope with a sudden spike in deaths. In a funeral home in Brooklyn, a crematory oven broke down under the heavy volume of corpses. Joe Sherman, the owner of another funeral home in Brooklyn, and who had been in the business for 43 years, observed that the pandemic brought so many more deaths than we could have ever imagined. The virus also increased demand for certain goods, testing equipment, hand sanitizer, drugs and vaccines, ventilators, and PPE. In March 2020, the 43 men who worked at the Braskem petrochemical plant in Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania, volunteered to stay at the factory nonstop for 28 days to produce huge amounts of the raw material required for the manufacture of PPE. They brought air mattresses and shaving kits to the factory, converted an office kitchen into a mess hall, and worked 12-hour alternating shifts nonstop, day and night, without going home or allowing anyone else inside. Together, they produced 40 million pounds of polypropylene, enough to make 500 million N95 masks. The front office pitched in too, paying the workers for all 24 hours of every day. The men worked with a renewed sense of purpose. One of their leaders, Joe Boyce, a 27-year veteran of the factory, said, when they finally exited a month later, "We were just happy to be able to help. We've been getting messages on social media from nurses, doctors, EMS workers, saying thank you for what we're doing. But we want to thank them for what they did and are continuing to do. That's what made the time we were in there go by quickly, just being able to support them." Many other companies responded by shifting production. Liquor distilleries began making hand sanitizer, and some gave it away for free to help out. Sportswear manufacturers shifted from making T-shirts to making masks. Working with GE and 3M, Ford Motor Company used repurposed car parts, such as fans and batteries, to make simplified ventilators. Many of the industries that provide items to combat the virus itself will see elevated demand continue for the duration of the immediate pandemic period, though not with the same intensity as during the first wave. While distilleries will probably switch back to making drinks, and Ford will go back to making cars, other structural changes in our economy could be long-lasting. Global supply chains could shrink, and there might be full repatriation of manufacturing facilities of certain industries, for instance, the pharmaceutical industry or high-tech machinery. Before the pandemic, the emphasis was on just-in-time production, with parts being delivered just when they were needed in the manufacturing process. Maintaining stockpiles was expensive and inefficient. But in the post-pandemic period, the emphasis could shift to some extent to just-in-case supply chains. One model the pandemic may accelerate is flexible, automated, small-batch factories that can manufacture goods to specification close to their needed consumption, which could even be cost-saving. As people adopted physical distancing and prepared for shelter-in-place orders, the economy had to respond to the indirect effects of the virus as well. There was initial panic buying of supplies, motivated in part by people seeking a sense of control. Filling a cart with canned goods, flour, cleaning products, and batteries made many people feel like they could influence what happened to them. Others, as we saw in Chapter 5, responded to feelings of fear and insecurity by purchasing guns. Consumption of discretionary items declined as people postponed non-essential purchases. Indeed, the greater the degree of social contact people had with others who had contracted or died from the virus, the lower their consumption of non-essential items. For instance, a 10% increase in the number of COVID-19 cases in a person's social circle resulted in a 2% decrease in purchases of clothing and cosmetics by that person. Beer, wine, and liquor sales reached a historic high in March 2020 due to an unprecedented spike in demand. Much of this was simply a shift away from purchases at bars and restaurants since they were closed. Something similar helped explain the perplexing toilet paper shortage in the early months of the pandemic. Though hoarding was a factor, it did not totally account for the shortage. Nor was there something about the virus that made people need more toilet paper, unlike hand sanitizer or cleaning products. Rather, since people no longer spent half their time at work, more bathroom breaks took place at home. But industrial paper products could not be easily diverted. Unbeknownst to most people, the manufacture and distribution of toilet paper in the United States is bifurcated. Paper products for offices and factories form a totally different supply chain than those intended for home use, which meant that many grocery stores were short on toilet paper for months. After an initial drop-off in home deliveries in early March, companies like UPS and FedEx started showing huge demand, similar to the level seen around Christmas, beginning in April 2020, and they had to impose surcharges on deliveries. Amazon had to hire 100,000 more warehouse workers to fill orders for all the people staying at home and give employees raises. Grocery and takeout and other delivery services boomed as well. While deliveries became more expensive, prices for goods and services less in demand dropped. Oil showed a stunning decline, which was reflected in the price of gas at the pump. For a brief period in April 2020, the price of oil fell below zero, meaning oil refineries had to pay their customers to take barrels of oil off their hands. The price of clothes, cars, and airline tickets also dropped as demand dried up. New vehicle sales declined by 40%, and General Motors and Ford shut down their factories. But eggs and meat were scarcer, and their prices rose. In an explosion of national solidarity and good marketing, many companies, especially those for which marginal costs were low, offered services for free. Companies providing online tools to stay connected, like file transfer or video conferencing, gave away their products to facilitate working from home. A consortium of cable companies, including Comcast and Verizon, signed a pledge with the FCC to keep Americans connected in March 2020, not canceling internet service even if customers could not pay their bills. U-Haul gave college students 30 days of free storage to help them cope with the disruptions in the middle of March 2020 when colleges shut down. The economy changed in still other ways. The demand for RVs in the summer of 2020 skyrocketed as people decided that this was a way to enjoy a vacation, isolated with their family, without the risk of airports or hotels. RVs seemed a promising solution until the CDC, ever the killjoy, reminded the nation that RV travel typically means staying at RV parks overnight and getting gas and supplies at other public places. These stops may put you and those with you in the RV in close contact with others. Businesses that rely on public gatherings, like restaurants and sports arenas, were greatly affected early in the pandemic, and this will persist through the intermediate pandemic period. By the end of March 2020 alone, 3% of restaurants had gone out of business outright, and 11% feared they would not make it through April. Even once reopened, in the late spring of 2020 in most places, restaurants were able to operate at only 50% capacity. About 15 million people are employed in restaurants as waiters, cooks, and so on, and half of them saw their jobs disappear. The hotel industry was similarly devastated. Bookings completely evaporated. The same thing happened in the entertainment industry, and in the conference industry, and in the car rental industry, and in the airline industry. An analysis using credit card transactions of a sample of 60,000 small businesses around the nation showed that, at the nadir, in April 2020, 30% of small businesses had closed, and as of late May, 19% remained closed, their owners uncertain if they would reopen. This is staggering. A change in attitudes about risk prompted the emergence of firms that offered, in business parlance, safety as a service or safety as a value proposition. In hotels, airlines, restaurants, salons, gyms, and so on, there will be a trade-off between price and safety in favor of safety, observed N. Chandrasekaran, the chief executive officer of the Tata conglomerate. Indeed, hotels started to market themselves along these lines. "We take the greatest care to ensure your stay with us is safe, clean, and comfortable," the Warwick in New York City noted in a flyer it sent out. Gone were emphases on location, excitement, or dining. In their place were enhanced preventative measures to comply with the latest guidance on cleaning and hygiene. The ripple effects throughout the economy have been enormous, and we have seen only the beginning. Over the intermediate term, cities could be duller as many small retail firms go out of business, leaving only large, well-capitalized chains to fill the urban landscape. As people continue to shift to working from home, employers could realize that they need less office space, which means fewer custodians, building managers, rental agents, and so on. For some people, the reality of having to obey stay-at-home orders for a family of four in a two-bedroom apartment in the city might not be something they want to repeat, spurring them to look for housing in less urban areas, shifting demand in the enormous real estate industry. But even cities are finding ways to change their layouts during the pandemic. In May 2020, New York City closed over 40 miles of streets to cars in order to facilitate outdoor recreation while respecting physical distancing, and cities around the country converted parking spaces to outdoor restaurants, as is typical in Europe. Many of these changes will last beyond the immediate period. New opportunities have arisen in multiple industries. Some indications suggest that the pace of patent applications is increasing, as inventors stuck at home have time to be more creative. The pandemic could accelerate improvements in autonomous robotics. Many robots able to clean surfaces with chemicals, or even, more efficiently, with UV light, have been deployed to help protect frontline custodial staff or hospital personnel entering rooms where COVID-19 patients were cared for. Other robots have been deployed to deliver groceries and food from restaurants around the country. Contactless methods of payment have already proliferated, but we might see fully automated convenience stores built like walk-in vending machines with automated tellers. Working conditions will also change. Prior to the pandemic, less than half of shift workers in the United States had access to paid sick leave, so most workers still went to work when they were ill. But the dynamics of a contagious disease make it abundantly clear why this is a bad idea. And hence many companies, from Apple to pizza delivery firms, provided paid sick leave to hourly workers for the first time in their history. Not wanting to repeat the errors made by the meatpacking plants that we discussed in Chapter 5, companies increased benefits to encourage their workers to stay home if sick with COVID-19. Such policies are likely to endure after the virus subsides, either because companies see the wisdom of it, legislation enforces it, or workers demand it. The shift to working from home will also linger. In the post-pandemic period, work days for many employees will get shorter or be better aligned with school days. Some companies have already eliminated in-office work, and others will follow. N. Chandrasekaran of Tata forecasts that most of the 450,000 employees of Tata Consulting Services, one of the world's largest and most successful management consulting companies, will continue to work from home after the pandemic. Approximately a fifth of the company's employees, based in India, the United States, Britain, and elsewhere, worked from home before the pandemic, but he estimates that three-quarters will do so afterwards. The digital disruption is so significant that most of us cannot imagine the degree, Chandrasekaran said. The pandemic has accelerated digital trends that will stick after it has gone. Technology companies like Twitter, Square, and Facebook announced that they were making working from home a permanent option for employees into the post-pandemic period. Ryan Smith, the CEO of Qualtrics, observed, "We have gone through a one-way door. We can't go back, in part because some organizations have offered to let people work remotely permanently." Indeed, early studies reveal that the transition was unexpectedly smooth. Office workers' job satisfaction and engagement fell dramatically in the first 2 weeks of working from home in the United States when the lockdowns were initiated, one study found, but once people adjusted, 8 weeks into the experience, their job satisfaction recovered rapidly. One employee observed, "I think it's weird how normal everything has become, the virtual meetings, the emails, everyone looking grungy." And a CEO noted that he felt this experience put an end to the fly across the country for a one-hour meeting expectation forever. Because of the positive experience, many of the changes are likely to be permanent. Why might the national experiment of working from home, forced on the American economy, have a better outcome than prior company-specific efforts that showed drops in productivity or increases in worker alienation? Two key factors are likely at play. First, this time, all the people in an organization, not just a small group that other employees might label as aberrant, are working from home, as are the workers in the companies they do business with. And second, people are motivated to band together to make the experience more functional. In the past, the subset of employees who worked from home would typically feel left out and be less able to contribute. However, making such a change more permanent will pose other problems, ranging from the greater difficulty in onboarding new employees and fostering their enculturation to the norms of the firm, to the loss of serendipitous and often innovative encounters in the physical space of the office. Moreover, working from home could undergo unappealing changes. Surveillance of the kind we saw for exam proctoring might be attempted by some companies, for example, by using keystroke monitoring to make sure employees stay on task or tracking emails or calendars more stringently. The economics and models of the education industry and the workforce trained in educational institutions are also undergoing changes at multiple levels. Childcare and school reforms have been debated for centuries, of course, but sustained changes could be on the horizon. Access to childcare will be a real problem in the immediate pandemic period, lasting into the intermediate pandemic period. Childcare is an extraordinarily low-margin business, even as the costs of childcare are crushing to many American families. And the pandemic has heightened the precarious financial state of childcare centers and the 2 million providers who staff them. Their 2017 median hourly wage was $10.72. A July 2020 survey from the National Association for the Education of Young Children indicated that 40% of childcare centers and half of minority-owned centers would close permanently without significant public investment as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Close to 90% of the centers open for business at the time of the survey had seen significant drops in enrollment as they faced increased expenses for PPE, extra cleanings, and other changes associated with infection prevention. Nearly three-quarters of the programs reported current or future furloughs, layoffs, and pay cuts. These ongoing pressures will likely prompt Americans to elect more officials who back imaginative solutions to this chronic problem for working parents and those who care for their children. With respect to K-12 schooling, although much of the response to the 2020 remote learning experience has been negative, we will likely see an increase in hybrid models of remote in-person schooling, especially for high school students and families who resist returning their children to bricks-and-mortar schools. We may also see a crisis in substitute teaching, a low-paying and often unrewarding job that schools find difficult to fill. An average of 6% of a child's K-12 experience is taught by substitute teachers, however, and with strict health criteria barring sick teachers from coming to school, as well as their fear and anxiety about being there, we can expect more teacher absences in the immediate and intermediate pandemic periods and fewer resources to deal with them. In the longer term and into the post-pandemic period, there is a real opportunity to revitalize a 100-year-old model of K-12 delivery that cries out for innovation. Schools have always played a dual role of educating children and housing them while parents work, but this double duty reinforces a narrow view of what learning should look like, a view that is confined to particular buildings, schedules, and dates. Children's developmental needs are often ignored in this schema. For example, there are schools without outdoor spaces of any kind. To promote a more inclusive view of learning befitting 21st century America, it may be time to think more imaginatively about how and where children learn best, and then figure out how to make those learning opportunities possible in a way that protects parents' work hours. Educators have noted these concerns for decades, but the post-pandemic pressures of disease prevention, new economic realities, and 21st-century technological advances may finally push school systems to explore radical innovation. Eventually, a smaller number of physical schools might come to function as primary learning hubs, with learning spokes found at home, in libraries, museums, community colleges, clubs, enrichment programs, and elsewhere in the community. We can expect that already heated debates about school consolidation and school choice will likely accelerate as public schools adopt a more personalized approach to education and as a variety of adults, coaches, counselors, college students, homeschooling parents, online experts, assume greater responsibility for children's learning. The disarray prompted by the pandemic is likely to provide an impetus for such a rethinking at higher levels of education, too. When the pandemic struck, universities had already been trying to shift to provide more instruction online. Universities are sure to continue to offer both in-person and online experiences even after the virus subsides. Of course, unlike universities in Europe or at domestic community colleges, many four-year colleges in the United States are organized around the in-person residential experience. Personal interactions are seen as the key to emotional and intellectual growth. But a kind of residential life arms race has proliferated in recent years, with huge investments in residential facilities, student centers and dormitories with fancy amenities, and lots of mid-level deans and administrators contributing to higher tuitions and alarming debt loads. The availability of online instruction might shift the emphasis away from such expenditures and lead more applicants to question their value. While I have spent my career advocating for the utility of face-to-face classroom instruction and on-campus living, the ability to teach classes asynchronously online, so that students do not all have to be in the same place at the same time, has its advantages. One likely outcome is that more professors will record lectures for online delivery, and students might be told to watch these lectures in preparation for class. Class time could then be reserved for more personal interactions or questions and discussion in what a colleague of mine, physicist and educational innovator Eric Mazur, calls a flipped classroom, where the students do more talking than the teacher. But a shift to online learning would change the value proposition for many colleges. Large universities would likely be able to offer an online alternative at low marginal cost. But hundreds of small colleges will face closure as students and families opt for online instruction at schools without an on-campus experience. As with the other cascade effects we have considered, this would put teachers and administrators and other employees out of work and would affect all the supporting businesses, from bars to bookshops, in countless small college towns across the country. Even before the pandemic, there was already a shift toward moving academic and other conferences online, partly prompted by concern for the environment. It has been estimated that the 7.8 million researchers who travel to conferences each year produce the carbon emissions of a small nation. Moving conferences online would also be more welcoming to scholars with disabilities, parents with young children, and those constrained by religious holidays. One of the longest-lasting economic effects concerns the cohort of students graduating from college into a recession. They are unlikely to catch up economically. They are predicted to endure lower wages for at least 20 years. Ironically, however, such people in prior recessions have reported more job satisfaction even 15 years later and even after accounting for occupation, income, and industry. When people begin their jobs during a recession, they appear to feel more fortunate about having a job in the first place. Psychologist Adam Grant has argued that the ripple effects of the pandemic may even include more ethical leadership of our major corporations. Surviving tough times and beginning one's career when unemployment is high may reduce feelings of entitlement or narcissism, especially among men, and leaders of corporations may thereafter have a different sense of purpose. After the intermediate pandemic period ends in about 2024, there will still be normative, social, technological, and economic aftereffects of the virus and our responses to it. Some are hard to foresee, but other changes are easier to predict. If history is a guide, it seems likely that consumption will come back with a vengeance. Periods of plague-driven austerity have often been followed by periods of liberal spending. This observation extends far back. Agnolo di Tura, a shoemaker and tax collector who chronicled the Black Death in 1348, noted, "And then, when the pestilence abated, all who survived gave themselves over to pleasures. Monks, priests, nuns, and laymen and women all enjoyed themselves, and none worried about spending and gambling. And everyone thought himself rich because he had escaped and regained the world, and no one knew how to allow himself to do nothing." If the Roaring Twenties following the 1918 pandemic are a guide, the increased religiosity and reflection of the immediate and intermediate pandemic periods could give way to increased expressions of risk-taking, intemperance, or joie de vivre in the post-pandemic period. The great appeal of cities will be apparent once again. People will relentlessly seek opportunities for social mixing on a larger scale in sporting events, concerts, and political rallies. And after a serious epidemic, people often feel not only a renewed sense of purpose, but a renewed sense of possibility. The 1920s brought the widespread use of the radio, jazz, the Harlem Renaissance, and women's suffrage. Of course, the 1918 flu pandemic followed World War I and was itself more deadly. But we can expect to see similar technological, artistic, and even social innovations after the current pandemic. For instance, reflecting the ripple effects of larger numbers of people working from home. The economic aftereffects of the COVID-19 pandemic will also likely be substantial. We have already considered the probable intermediate-term backlash against globalization immigration, and urban living, but any such changes seem unlikely to persist past 2024, since the economic benefits of those long-term trends are so compelling. Other economic aftershocks of the pandemic may endure longer, however. A sustained recession could snowball into a true depression with effects of longer duration. It can be difficult to differentiate the adverse economic impact of the virus itself from the adverse economic effects of the non-pharmaceutical interventions people implemented in response. Viruses can sicken and kill people and compromise the economy directly. And the precautions that people take in response, such as not spending their money or avoiding social interactions, can have adverse economic impacts on their own. A careful analysis of the 1918 pandemic in the United States that took advantage of variation in the timing of the arrival of the virus from place to place, as well as variation in the timing of implementation of the non-pharmaceutical interventions as a kind of natural experiment, concluded that it was the pandemic itself that depressed the economy, not the public health responses. Moreover, cities that implemented stricter non-pharmaceutical interventions and did so sooner in the course of the epidemic did not fare worse. Indeed, their economies bounced back more rapidly after the pandemic was over. For example, reacting 10 days earlier with respect to the arrival of the pandemic increased manufacturing employment by 5% after the epidemic ended. One analysis of the long-term economic impact of pandemics used painstakingly assembled data from 12 European pandemics, ranging from the first attack of the Black Death in the 1340s to the mild H1N1 pandemic of 2009, and including the European cholera epidemic of 1816, the 1918, 1957, and 1968 influenza pandemics, and various other outbreaks. In general, by killing working-age adults, but leaving agricultural lands, buildings, mines, metals, and other capital assets relatively untouched, these deadly pandemics, on average, resulted in a rise in real wages and a long-term decline in interest rates. After many people die in a serious pandemic, labor is generally scarce relative to capital. This is in contrast to major wars, which typically result in destruction of capital in addition to human lives. Investment opportunities are depressed given the excess of capital. Furthermore, people generally start saving more in the aftermath of a pandemic. As a result, the natural rate of interest is reduced for nearly 40 years overall, but especially over the first 20, where, at the nadir, real interest rates are depressed by 2 percentage points. Real wages show the same pattern in reverse, remaining elevated for decades after a pandemic that kills many working-age adults, with wages peaking at 5% higher than they would have otherwise. To be clear, these effects are sustained across time, whereas the effects on the cohort of college students graduating into a recession, discussed earlier, relate to that one cohort facing the immediate shock. The people enduring historical pandemics were often aware of some of these impacts. An account of the Black Death that devastated Rochester, England in the middle of the 14th century, attributed to William de la Denne, noted a brewing class conflict. Such a shortage of workers ensued that the humble turned up their noses at employment and could scarcely be persuaded to serve the eminent unless for triple wages. Instead, because of the doles handed out at funerals, those who once had to work now began to have time for idleness, thieving, and other outrages, and thus the poor and servile have been enriched and the rich impoverished. As a result, churchmen, knights, and other worthies have been forced to thresh their corn, plow the land, and perform every other unskilled task if they are to make their own bread. However, because the COVID-19 pandemic has largely spared working-age people, and because it is not as intrinsically deadly as bubonic plague or smallpox, it is very unlikely to shift the balance of power between capital and labor quite as much as prior plagues have. Still, the pandemic may very well drive up wages via political pressure. The COVID-19 pandemic revealed the country's dependence on essential low-wage workers, and even without large numbers of working-age adult deaths, laws that better enshrine worker protections in the United States in the post-pandemic period are likely. As we have seen, possible areas for improvement are paid sick and family leave, more flexible work schedules, and perhaps childcare subsidization. This is especially likely if there is sustained political activism beyond the initial burst of sympathy for grocery store clerks, delivery drivers, and nursing home staff. The process is unlikely to be smooth, but the COVID-19 pandemic struck, by coincidence, at a time when income inequality in the United States was already at a century-long high, in ways that have increasingly come to be seen by many citizens as unsustainable. Many Americans may also come to better appreciate essential but unglamorous jobs that keep their lives running and may be more sympathetic to wage demands. The speed at which the United States recovers in relation to other countries could change its international standing. We have already seen a glimpse of this decline in stature as our leaders stumbled in their pandemic response to the first wave of the virus. As London-based journalist Tom McTague argued, it is hard to escape the feeling that this is a uniquely humiliating moment for America. As citizens of the world the United States created, we are accustomed to listening to those who loathe America, admire America, and fear America, sometimes all at the same time. But feeling pity for America? That one is new. The loss of American economic power and the lack of U.S. leadership could create an opening for China to exert more influence, particularly in the developing world, where many countries desperately need help to cope with the virus and where American responses to the global pandemic have not been up to prior standards. Though there will also be a backlash against China as the country of origin of the virus, and especially given its initial lack of transparency. A lot of power will flow to those countries that successfully develop a good vaccine or effective medicine. The possible decrease in stature of the United States may paradoxically both constrain and open up the future of young Americans. They may see themselves as more connected to the global community and more dependent on it too. Growing up during the pandemic will surely shape a generation of youth in other ways. Pandemics can leave a mark and change life trajectories in young adulthood, as we saw with a projected income trajectory forecast for new college graduates. The effects are different at younger ages. Our 10-year-old son, for example, mostly responded to the disruption in his life with insouciance, spending time outdoors and enjoying the suspension of school while he learned at home. But he also articulated that he was worried that my wife Erica and I would die, and the social isolation was very difficult for him. For large numbers of American children in less privileged circumstances, the challenges have been far greater. Quite a few may have experienced the pandemic as a traumatic adverse childhood event, especially if their parents lost their jobs or their lives, and the memory of it will linger. Given that 45% of Americans already have at least one adverse childhood experience, for example, the death or mental illness of a parent, and 10% have three or more such experiences, the pandemic may amplify young people's already worrying mental health trends, such as increasing behavioral problems and rising suicide rates. We may see an epidemic of post-traumatic stress disorder in the post-pandemic period as these children grow older, especially if parents are unable to control their own anxiety and if traditional outlets for children's well-being, such as sports and free play, are curtailed. Some educators are concerned that the already well-documented diminishment of broader areas of curriculum, such as art, music, physical education, and social studies, will only accelerate as schools provide a more stripped-down educational experience in the immediate pandemic period. This could have ramifications for years. However, a minority of children may actually return to school with more resilience, and they could fare better in the long term too. Pandemic disease can have effects even earlier in a child's life. Early life exposures to the Spanish flu, either in utero or immediately after birth, had a lasting impact on morbidity, mortality, and socioeconomic status later in life. For example, Taiwanese children born in 1919 were shorter and experienced later growth spurts compared to their counterparts in adjacent birth cohorts. For American children born between 1915 and 1923, prenatal exposure to the Spanish flu was linked to a more than 20% increase in the rate of ischemic heart disease after the age of 60 compared to those with little or no prenatal exposure. Prenatal exposure to the Spanish flu has also been linked to lower educational attainment, a 5-month decrease for those with infected mothers and a 4-5% lower likelihood of completing high school, annual income, $2,500 lower for sons of infected mothers, and higher rates of physical disability, 8% greater likelihood of experiencing work-preventing disability. Similar detrimental effects of in utero exposure to the Spanish flu have been seen in Brazilian and Swedish samples. Finally, our arts and literature will be imbued with pandemic-related symbolism. Already by the summer of 2020, I started to spot still lifes that featured face masks and other allusions to disease on Instagram accounts of artists. After severe epidemics in the past, the arts have gone in new directions. For instance, after 1918, Romanticism faded and Classicism made a comeback as artists, fashion designers, and architects attempted to slough off the excess of the turn of the century. The post-1918 decade was a time in which artists said, "We had nothing on the ancients after all. We were just as prone to catastrophe and death." In her essay, On Being Ill, Virginia Woolf complained that the culture had neglected an obvious source of inspiration. Novels, one would have thought, would be devoted to influenza, epic poems to typhoid, odes to pneumonia, but no. The 1918 pandemic did indeed leave some mark on literature. For example, in Chapter 6, we saw its influence on Hemingway's work. The bubonic plague had a more dramatic effect on Western art, bringing to the fore, in shockingly graphic detail, the human preoccupations with death, pain, and sin. Peter Bruegel the Elder's 1562 painting, The Triumph of Death, is a hellscape of bodily dysfunction. Skeletons are seen pushing cartloads of skulls or decapitating, hanging, and drowning hapless victims while dogs pick at cadavers. Edvard Munch's Self-Portrait with the Spanish Flu in 1919 is a startling evocation of the impact of the pandemic on the human body, with its echoes of his more famous The Scream of Nature painting writ across his haunted, open-mouth gaze. The young artist Keith Haring, who died of AIDS at age 31, painted a famous poster in 1989 about the HIV pandemic with a legend, "Silence equals death," in which three figures ape the "see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil" proverb about the three wise monkeys. It became an iconic image. The pandemic may possibly reverse certain political and cultural trends that have, in my view, bedeviled our society in recent years. Early in the pandemic, I became worried that the thinning out of our intellectual life over the past 20 years would pose barriers for managing the spread of the virus. Political entrenchment and geographically separated living patterns have made people less open to opposing ideas, and this has hampered addressing a variety of societal problems, from climate change to mass incarceration. I feared that, together with a number of other problematic convergent features, this intellectual atrophy could make our response to the pandemic challenging. First, there has been a progressive denigration of science. Science has come to be seen by too many as serving political ends. Many people have even abandoned the fundamental idea that it is possible to have an objective appreciation of the truth. For instance, right-wing politicians have not wanted to acknowledge findings from climate science or gun violence research, and left-wing politicians have wished to deny the role of genetics in human behavior. Rather than engage difficult topics head-on, using our best efforts at objective research, many people have found it easier to ignore inconvenient truths and suppress the scientific inquiry that might reveal them. Scientific literacy is low among the general public as well. A total of 38% of Americans believe that God created humans in their present form sometime in the last 10,000 years. Over 25% of Americans believe that the sun revolves around the earth. And 61% cannot correctly identify that the universe began with the Big Bang. Substantial fractions of people reject the efficacy of vaccines, and some believe wild conspiracy theories, like the idea that airplane exhaust is used by the government to control the populace. Distinct from the denigration of science, there has been a downgrading of expertise and a progressive anti-elitism in our society, fostered by extremists at both ends of the political continuum. Experts are seen as out-of-touch elites, and expert knowledge is seen as a kind of conspiracy aimed at obtaining resources for the privileged at the expense of the masses. But many people, in many occupations, devote their lives to developing mastery. The sociologist Everett C. Hughes famously noted that one person's emergency is another person's ordinary employment. When you have a big plumbing leak in your house, it's an unusual event and an emergency for you, but it is a routine event for the plumber who comes to repair it. This is how society has been organized since the time that people began to urbanize and develop specialties and means to barter knowledge as well as goods. When you are searching for a mechanic or a surgeon, you want expertise and competence. The irony is that this tendency to disparage science and expertise coexists with a respect for scientists themselves. One national survey conducted at the end of April 2020 found very large fractions of the population trusted scientists and physicians. For example, 88% of Americans reported that they had some or a lot of trust in the CDC. 96% had such trust in hospitals and doctors, and 93% had such trust in scientists and researchers. What are we to make of the perplexing fact that so many aspects of our national response to the pandemic were nevertheless contentious? I think what is happening is that people trust science until it conflicts with their personal, religious, or ethical values. Most Americans, 73%, believe that science generally has a positive effect on society. And 86% of Americans have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in scientists to act in the public interest. But many Americans also want scientists to stay in their labs and not actually influence policy, with 60% saying that scientists should take an active role in policy debates and 39% saying they should simply focus on establishing sound scientific facts. This is divided along partisan lines. 73% of Democrat-leaning citizens support scientists taking an active role, compared with 43% of Republican-leaning citizens. Yet scientists have often been at the forefront of important issues, from nuclear war to disability rights. In fact, Americans are evenly divided on whether scientific experts make better policy decisions than other people, with 45% saying they do and 48% saying they do not. 7% say their decisions are actually worse than other people's. But there is a partisan divide here too, with 54% of Democrats saying scientists' policy decisions are usually better, and just 34% of Republicans feeling this way. And despite the overall confidence in science, many Americans also express suspicion. 63% say the scientific method generally produces accurate conclusions, but 35% think it can be used to produce any conclusion the researcher wants. These unfortunate features of American culture, coupled with a centuries-old history of embracing visionaries, charlatans, and quacks, intersected with the especially politically polarized environment of 2020, making the bad situation worse. A national survey conducted in April 2020 evaluated partisan divides across a range of public health behaviors recommended by experts. When asked if they were following a selection of recommendations, Democrats and Republicans reported different levels of participation. For avoiding contact with other people, the fraction was 75% versus 67%. Avoiding crowded places was 79% versus 72%. And wearing a mask outside the home was 64% versus 50%. None of these are remotely controversial from an epidemiological point of view. Getting the evidence right as best as we could at any given moment was crucial in controlling the epidemic. As Dr. Fauci noted in an interview when he tried to explain the importance of science in combating such threats, sooner or later, something that really is true will get confirmed time after time after time, and something that in good faith was thought to be true but isn't, when the scientific process repeats it over and over again, all of a sudden you realize, you know, there was something about that that wasn't quite right. So as long as science is humble enough and open enough and transparent enough to accept self-correction, it's a beautiful process. But science cannot work as intended when scientific findings, say, about the utility of masks or vaccines, are interpreted as political statements. Finally, there is the loss of the capacity for nuance in our public discourse. Problems and policies are framed and seen as black and white. The tolerance for shades of gray and complexity is low. That makes it difficult for scientists to communicate that we do not know exactly what will happen with this pandemic, but that there is a range of options, each with a certain probability, and we should act accordingly. Neither blind confidence nor total panic is justified. In an era of soundbites, coping with the complexity of a pathogen that scientists are only beginning to understand has not been an easy task. When coupled with the underlying exponential growth seen in infectious disease outbreaks, which sneaks up on decision makers, this often resulted in the public being behind the curve in its response. Of course, as we saw, the desire for simplicity and certainty during a time of complexity, uncertainty, and danger can lead to lies and false reassurance by politicians and hucksters. Politicians around the country, including the President of the United States and others in the White House, promulgated information that was plainly scientifically false from the outset. Asymptomatic transmission was possible. Non-pharmaceutical interventions did save thousands of lives. COVID-19 was much more serious than the flu. Despite all this, I think that one of the unexpected impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic may be that a society that feels besieged by the threat of the virus will increasingly treat scientific information, and not just scientists, seriously. We have seen this in other countries. Previously obscure doctors and physicians, and not just Dr. Fauci, have suddenly become household names as they calmly explained what was known about the epidemic. It's possible this might be one of the lasting impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, an increased respect for science and expertise, even when it leads to people taking actions they would rather avoid. Perhaps after the dust settles from the pandemic and humanity moves on to other threats that require scientific understanding, such as climate change, the voice of experts might be given more weight. After all, other large-scale threats have historically prompted scientific innovation, and we may see this again. The 1918 pandemic stimulated developments in microbiology and public health. The Manhattan Project during World War II contributed to tremendous advances in physics. The 1957 launch of Sputnik, the first Soviet satellite, prompted heavy American investment in space science and engineering. The war on cancer, declared in 1971, had a similar impact. Although it did not cure cancer, it advanced fundamental medical science. Perhaps the multi-trillion-dollar hit to the American economy by the COVID-19 pandemic will make multi-billion-dollar investments in science, from virology to medicine to epidemiology to data science, seem well worth it. Plagues can also lead to long-term shifts in how we think about government and leaders. In medieval times, the manifest inability of rulers, priests, doctors, and others in positions of authority to control the course of the plague led to a wholesale loss of faith in the corresponding institutions and a strong desire for new sources of authority. Some scholars have speculated that this set the stage for the rise of capitalism and even of the Reformation, since it became very clear that the priests had no way of stopping mortality from the plague. This may have spurred developments in empirical medicine, too, since doctors also were ineffective at stemming the tide of death. It is possible that the inability of our political institutions to fight the virus will have similar implications. We saw earlier that interest in collective state action will likely rise in the immediate and intermediate pandemic periods, but if the actions are incompetent, confidence in political institutions will fall. The incompetence of our government in confronting the pandemic especially when compared to the responses of other countries, coupled with the essential necessity of strong collective action to combat epidemic disease, may result in a shift in political preferences aimed at undoing the existing order. Given the strong coordinated state action that is required to achieve control of the virus, it is likely that the role of government itself will increase from the immediate pandemic period into the post-pandemic period. The worse the pandemic gets, the more people will expect from themselves, from others, and from the state. Chapter 8: How Plagues End. Dr. Rieu resolved to compile this chronicle so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure, and to state quite simply what we learn in time of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise. Albert Camus, The Plague, 1947. One day in 1902, an American second lieutenant named George Marshall crossed a small river on the island of Mindoro, Philippines, to pay a visit to a local leader and his three young daughters. The attractive girls were apparently the main draw. They laughed and made chit-chat and sang delightfully. Social visits were conducted in the mornings in those days to avoid the oppressive heat. Marshall left, but later that same day, he had cause to return to the village, where he joined the funeral for the same four families.